I am the Bhagadam, I am the Dhati Sabhadam. We're reading from the 44th chapter of the 10th canto. And in this chapter, Kamsa will be killed. So Krishna has entered the wrestling arena after killing the elephant Kuvalaya Pita. And he's looking exceptionally beautiful, even though he's so young and delicate. And the wrestlers are so huge and powerful. Krishna's body is fully spiritual and unlimitedly powerful. So, but yet the audience, they're either partially aware or not aware, or some fully aware of Krishna's unlimited power. After all, he's just killed a huge elephant that was stronger than 10,000 elephants. So the two great wrestlers, Chanura and Mastika, who are huge, they're like those bodybuilders. You know, if you go to the gym, you see certain people their whole life, and their bodies are meant for that. You know, they're huge. All their muscles are developed. So this Chanura and Mastika were like them. And on the other hand, Krishna and Balaram were just delicate boys, one darkish and the other lightish. So the king, Kamsa, was eager to see the wrestling match begin, because this specifically was his plan. He wanted to have Krishna killed, and he has called him all the way from the Braja fields, the forest of Vrindavan, to this wrestling match externally as part of a festival, but practically speaking, actually speaking, he wants to have Krishna killed. And why? Because in the very first chapter of this 10th canto, it has been described how Kamsa was driving the chariot of Devaki and Vasudeva on their wedding day, and a voice from the sky, Akashvani, had announced that the eighth garbha, the eighth embryo of this girl, Devaki, will kill you. So Kamsa, you're so foolish. You're driving the chariot as if you're doing something wonderful, but you're driving your own... You're driving the chariot is going to be the cause of your death. You're so foolish. You're walking into this trap, smiling, but it is a trap. So since then, and that was in the first chapter, first or second chapter, and then this is the 44th chapter. Since then, Krishna has been growing up, and Kamsa is trying to kill Krishna. Now, finally, Krishna is in Mathura. And today I don't think we will get to the actual killing of Kamsa by Krishna, but in the next class, Krishna willing, we shall do that. But, so Krishna is in the wrestling arena. And again, he's young, he's delicate, and his opponents are huge and powerful. And, and the different arts of wrestling are being exhibited by Krishna and Balaram. So some of the people in the wrestling arena, though Kamsa is very enthusiastic to see this wrestling match, some of the people are thinking, this is terrible. This is the most irreligious, disgraceful thing. How could this young boy be fighting with this powerful wrestler? How could this go on? They're so unequal. They're so unequal in size, because according to religious principles, especially the principles of Kshatriyas, of warriors, that fighting only can take place between equals. And therefore, we see sometimes it's described in the Bhagavatam that if there's two warriors fighting and one loses his chariot, the other one won't take advantage and kill him, but he'll get off his chariot to fight with him. And then if he loses his sword, the other warrior will throw down his sword. So it's always a fight amongst equals. So here's this huge wrestler fighting, very delicate, beautiful and delicate Krishna. So the people in the wrestling arena, many of them, especially the ladies, they're appreciating the beauty of Krishna and how wonderful he looks. And some of the others are thinking that Krishna is so powerful. He's killed an elephant, and look how he's fighting. He's not disturbed at all by the blows and the wrestling and the pulling and the pushing and the throwing down by his opponent, Janur. But others are saying, no, this is so disturbing. But yet they're looking right at the, because it's unequal. And they're so devoted to Krishna, these people, because as it was described earlier, there were two ways that the people were relating with Krishna. Those who had a true relationship with him were relating with him and tasting transcendental sweetness, and those who had an indirect, inimical relationship with him, like the prisoners and the good citizens, they both have a relationship with the government. You can't avoid a relationship with the government. The criminals or a citizen, either way you have a relationship. So one is a fearful relationship and the other is a pleasant relationship. So similarly, those who have a direct relationship with Krishna, who are uninimical, who have a positive relationship with Krishna, don't have enmity. Krishna, bhule seji, anadhyam bahyamukh. Those who have not turned their back on Krishna, who are facing Krishna, who are awake and open in their relationship with him, they experience transcendental sweetness. And those who have turned their back on Krishna, they themselves trying to be the center of existence in this world. And that's basically how everyone thinks of themselves, the center of existence, imagining that the world is revolving around them and their desire. So the process of Krishna consciousness is a process of turning to Krishna. So in any case, those who have a relationship with Krishna, watching him wrestle in this wrestling arena, they're feeling terrible because of the unequal match between Krishna and his opponents, the wrestlers, the seemingly unequal. Actually, it is an unequal match because the wrestlers are extremely powerful, but Krishna is unlimitedly powerful. So extremely powerful on the material level compared to unlimitedly powerful. Extremely powerful on the material level becomes completely insignificant. It's like it's like a grain of sand. If you have a lot of grains of sand in your hand, what's that compared to the totality of grains of sand in existence? So if we have a very small conception of what a lot is, that one handful seems like so much. If we have a very small conception of what is powerful, a little bit of power in this world seems like so much. If we have a small conception of what is beautiful, a little bit of beauty in this world seems like so much, and true and wealth and fame and strength and knowledge, etc. But Krishna being Sadaishwarya Purnam, having all opulences to the fullest amount, he makes everyone else's strength or wealth or beauty appear completely insignificant. So there are 10 verses where those ladies who have a relationship with Krishna, direct, and are attracted to him, and have some affection for him, they speak what's on their mind as they watch the wrestling arena, the wrestling match. So we read some yesterday, and the first six are on one level, and then the last four verses are on a completely different level. There's a connection between the last four. The last four are discussed Braja or Vrindavan and the people of Vrindavan's relationship with Krishna. Because the people of Vrindavan, all they know is Krishna. Like the fish in the water doesn't, practically speaking, see the water. He's completely immersed in it continuously. So similarly, the residents of Vrindavan, all they know is Krishna. So, and they're acting sometimes as if they were ordinary people, but it's not ordinary, it's extraordinary, because they have such an intimate, loving relationship with Krishna, and the result of that intimate, loving relationship with Krishna is ecstasy. So sometimes it takes someone outside to describe, for us to understand the situation of the people in Vrindavan, what it's like being in Vrindavan with full love for Krishna, what the residents of Vrindavan, what their fortune is, what their ecstasy is. It's difficult for, just by looking at it, because it appears to be ordinary, even though it's extraordinary, it may be difficult for people to understand. So when someone else who has an appreciation, someone else on the outside has an appreciation for the love of the residents of Vrindavan, describing it in an intimate way in their fortune, then we can understand it more clearly. So the last four verses help us understand the great, incredible fortune of the people of Vrindavan. So we'll first read the first six verses. Alas, what a greatly irreligious act the members of this royal assembly are committing. As the king watches this fight between the strong and the weak, they also want to see it. What comparison can there be between these two professional wrestlers, whose limbs are as strong as lightning bolts, and whose bodies resemble mighty mountains? How can you compare them to these two young, immature boys whose bodily limbs are extremely tender? Religious principles have certainly been violated in this assembly. One should not remain for even a moment in a place where irreligion is flourishing. Why shouldn't one remain in a place where irreligion is flourishing?
Because he will get all the quality of irreligion.
Yes, and then what will be the result of getting the qualities of irreligion? You will act irreligiously. Yes. And what will be the result of acting irreligiously? Impiety. And impiety means suffering. So if you go to hell, or if you go to half hell, or if you have to, or you break all your bones, or you have court cases, or you have extreme health issues, or this kind of suffering, or that kind of suffering, these are all the result of impiety. So this, because impiety means suffering, or ultimately going to an animal birth where there is unlimited suffering. Unlimited suffering. Just like the trees, they cannot move. If it's so hot, they cannot drink more water than is there. If it is so cold, they suffer in that way. The only reason they don't die is because they have their feelings, their abilities to perceive things are so compressed from what a soul actually is. Such torture. Or the cats and the dogs and the monkeys, they have fleas, just imagine. And they don't even have hands to be able to. So difficult. Even just imagine how
what it's like without hands. You can't, so many things, and you can't communicate, and your intelligence is so small, and always afraid, and the birds are always going like this, and always afraid, even when they're high in a tree. If you go like this, they'll fly away because of fear, because they have no defense other than flying away. And it's cold and it's rainy. That's so much suffering. And a big bird comes or a cat comes.
So so that is the result of impiety, misuse of one's human life. So religious principles have certainly been violated in this assembly. One should not remain for even a moment in a place where irreligion is flourishing.
It's like if someone has a bad cough, everyone else will get the cough. If someone has a cold and they're always sneezing, everyone will get the cold. If someone has impiety, so everyone else surrounding them will catch it. And if someone has piety, people around will be influenced by that. So this is a principle, a satsanga tyag, evaishnava char, that one should not remain in bad association.
A wise person should not enter an assembly if he knows the participants there are committing acts of impropriety. And if, having entered such an assembly, he fails to speak the truth, speaks falsely, or pleads ignorance, he will certainly incur sin.
So three different circumstances. If a person walks into a situation where impiety is taking place, impious acts are taking place, so he could leave immediately. But if he stays there,
and he should speak against it. So if he fails to speak the truth, or if he speaks falsely, or he supports the impiety, or he said, oh, I didn't know, this pleads ignorance,
all those three reactions will incur sin, entanglement, further entanglement upon the person.
So this is what they people say. But then they start speaking more directly about Krishna. Because someone may say, 11 and 12 are about Krishna and Balaram.
And those are the fifth and sixth verses. Because someone may say, well, look, it's not so impious, because just as Chinura said, Krishna is so powerful. He's so powerful, it's no difficulty for him to fight these great wrestlers. So in response to that, Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur explains this verse in this light. No, it's not that Krishna isn't distressed by this fighting. Just see the lotus face of Krishna. So he has a lotus face. It's so beautiful.
But see the lotus face of Krishna as he darts around his foe. That face covered with drops of perspiration brought on by the strenuous fight resembles a lotus flower covered by dew.
So he's straining in this fight. So if someone is unlimitedly powerful, he just goes, and the other person is finished. But Krishna is fighting, he's straining. And what's the proof of that? His body is covered by perspiration. But oh, how beautiful Krishna looks in that situation. Because his body is compared, his face is compared to a lotus. Very soft, very gentle, very curved and colored in a darkish bluish way. In Vrindavan, in the very hot seasons, or after when the rainy season begins, the deities have garlands made out of lotus flowers. Very, very beautiful, and they have their darkish reddish part.
So he's beautiful,
but like a lotus flower is covered by morning dew, Krishna is covered by perspiration due to the strenuousness of this fight. And not only Krishna is struggling, But beautiful Balaram, don't you see the face of Lord Balaram with its eyes copper red from his anger? If it was easy for him, would he be angry? His eyes copper red from his anger towards Mastika, and his beauty enhanced by his laughter and his absorption in the fight. He's laughing in a particular mood of a warrior. So then, in those six verses, after describing the fight and hinting at the beauty of Krishna and hinting at the great fortune of the residents of Mathura because they're able to see the beauty of Krishna, then in the last four verses in these ten, they describe the fortune of the residents of Vrindavan and specifically of the Braja Gopis, because they always constantly see Krishna. The residents of Mathura who are watching this, they're seeing Krishna for the first time, and they're thinking that their eyes have been wasted. They've looked at so many things, but the eyes are always hankering to look at something beyond, more wonderful, and they're always unsatisfied, searching from one thing to the next. But the residents of Vrindavan have had the perfection of their eyes day after day after day, the purpose of their eyes. Akshanvantam phalamidam na param vidamaha. The true fruit, phalamidam, this akshanvantam, see, this vision is the true fruit of having eyes, is, and the vision is to see Krishna. And it's so amazing, even when one sees the deity of Krishna, if one takes care of deities, one has the experience that there you are, you have a murti, a vigraha, the form of Krishna, it doesn't change, and you just put new clothes on every day and you change the ornaments and still every day looks completely different, and it is, gives pleasure to the eyes. It's quite astounding, and pleasure to the eyes, pleasure to the soul, to oneself. It's quite astounding, isn't it? No answer. Isn't it quite astounding? You can see that you can see the deities every day, and they always look different.
Yes, it is quite astounding.
And they always appear ever fresh. See, I told you. I told you. Mm-hmm. It's quite astounding.
Confirmation.
Yeah. One needs confirmations in life. So they say. So this is the basic thrust on how fortunate the residents of Vrindavan are, and how especially fortunate are the Braja Gopis. Why? Because they have the opportunity to see Krishna. So, we have, there's, in different people have different concepts in their mind as to what makes a person fortunate. Some people think that if they, that all, especially at the end of one's life, nearing the end of one's life, one thinks there's only one cause of fortune, and that's health. I met someone in Hong Kong, an old man, elderly man. I don't want anything. I just want one thing. Just health. And of course, it was much too late for him to want that one thing because he was like 80 already, and he was shaking and everything. So he was lamenting, really, that his desire was really what was happening. He was preparing for his next body. and that was going to be, he was going to have a nice, young, healthy body, at least for some time. So according to one's mentality, one thinks of one thing or another as fortune or misfortune. If you're a fox, if you see a chicken, you'll think this is your great fortune. If you're a bird and you see a bug that you can eat, you'll think it's your fortune. And if you're a businessman and you see an opportunity to make money, it's your good fortune. You think that's your fortune. And if you're a lady whose husband has given you a credit card, you think spending his money is your greatest fortune. And or if your stocks go up or something like that. And conversely, bad fortune is also described as the opposite. So, what actually is good fortune? So here, what we are hearing and trying to deeply penetrate into is that good fortune is to see Krishna, to really see Krishna. And one sees with consciousness, with one's mind. One doesn't see with one's eyes, because one person may look at the chicken and think of eggs, and another person may look at the chicken and think of feathers, and another person may look at the chicken and think of, oh no, I don't want to be a chicken, and another person may look at a chicken and think this is a meal. Another person, it would be the last thing they think of is that. And someone may think, oh, what an unfortunate birth. Let me let that soul here within that body hear the holy names of Krishna. So one doesn't exactly see with one's eyes. One sees with one's mentality, one's consciousness. So these ladies who are in the wrestling arena are speaking about what is fortune, and it is saying Krishna that they're saying is the greatest fortune. But they're saying that the residents of Vrindavan have the most fortune, because not only do they see them every day, but especially the gopis, as it will come to describe, they have the consciousness that causes them to see Krishna in a particular way, or causes Krishna to reciprocate with their consciousness, so that they see in a particular way that causes the deepest love and the most ecstatic experience for them, and the most beauty becomes revealed because of their consciousness. So that's what these four verses are about. The fortune of the residents of Vrindavan, and specifically the gopis. So the first of these verses says, how pious are the tracts of land in Braja. For there the primeval personality of Godhead, disguising himself with human traits, wanders about enacting his many pastimes. Adorned with wonderfully variegated flower garlands, beautiful colors and fragrances of the Vanamala, the forest garlands. He whose feet are worshipped by Lord Shiva and Goddess Rama vibrates his flute as he tends the cows in the company of Balaram. I'll read the four verses so we get an idea, and then we'll read the comments and what Prabhupada says after. What austerities must the gopis have performed? With their eyes, they always drink the nectar of the Lord's form. Usually we think of our mouth as the organ for drinking. And one can drink nectar with one's mouth. But one usually doesn't think of drinking with one's eyes, or to speak of drinking some liquid with one's eyes. But the liquid beauty of Krishna is nectarian. And that nectar, the beauty of Krishna, is primarily drunk with the eyes. So what piety, what austerities must the gopis have performed? With their eyes, they always drink the nectar of Lord Krishna's form, which is the essence of loveliness, and not to be equaled or surpassed. The essence of loveliness, what a term. Because Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, I am the ability in man, that which everyone has different abilities. Some person can sing, some person can dance, some person can play the piano or keyboards, another person can play the drum, another person can so many things. But all these abilities, they spring from Krishna. So another person is beautiful, lovely. So if you took all the essences of all the people who are lovely or beautiful, if you gathered up all that quality of loveliness or beauty, and you gathered it up from all the people, or looking at it from something a little less abstract, if you took all the people who have musical ability in the world, there are some people who have musical ability, and some people don't have any musical ability. So if you like all the people who have musical ability, they all lined up, and they all donated to you that ability, and you gather it all together. And then the sum total of that ability, musical ability, would be compared to a small drop in the ocean of Krishna's musical ability. So with loveliness, it's hard, it's a little more abstract. What makes a person lovely or beautiful? We know what it is, but it's hard to say what it is. But if all that beauty or loveliness was gathered up, the essence of all that beauty and loveliness is the quality of Krishna. So they're saying that Krishna's form is the essence of loveliness, and it is not to be equaled or surpassed. Asama udham. That word is used. Asama means no equal, and udva, better. And it is anusharupam, lavanyasaram, the essence of loveliness. His form is so wonderful. That loveliness is the only abode of beauty, fame, and opulence. So beauty and fame and opulence live in the loveliness of Krishna's form. It's quite wonderful poetry, isn't it?
Beautiful.
And all opulence. Because if someone is extremely beautiful, unlimitedly beautiful. We can't even fathom what unlimited beauty is like. But very, very beautiful, they become famous. And they become opulent. More about Krishna's form. It is self-perfect, ever fresh, and extremely rare. That you don't see it very often, but they see it every day, Krishna's beauty. We're seeing it right now for the first time, and we're shocked by it. But it is not that, just like if you get something new in the beginning, it's so wonderful, but then in the contemporary phraseology, after a few days you're over it, you get over it, and it's no longer, it loses its glitter, it loses its freshness. But Krishna is self-perfect and ever fresh. That means he's Navayovanam. He's always freshly exhibiting his youthful beauty continuously, moment by moment by moment by moment by moment by moment. It's ever fresh and new. And it's extremely rare to see this. And yet, the residents of Vrindavan, the gopis, what did they do in this life or in previous lives? What austerities must they perform? That form, which is so rare, which is the essence of loveliness, which is self-perfect and ever-fresh, they see it every day. So what kind of fortune is that? What austerities did they perform? Because of whatever austerities they performed, these ladies in Mathura are thinking, I want to do those austerities because that's just what I want. I'm ready to do anything. So this tatraloyam apimulam ekalam, this is the mood of a true devotee. They're ready to do whatever is required to become close to Krishna, to please him. So what austerities must they have performed? Because with their eyes they always drink the nectar of the Lord's form, which is the essence of loveliness. It's not equal, what to speak of, not being surpassed. That loveliness is the only abode of beauty, fame, and opulence. Those qualities live in the loveliness of Krishna, the abode. It is self-perfect. It is perfect in itself. It doesn't need, just like if you have a gem, a diamond, you have to put it in a setting. In India, they like, in the West, the Western taste for diamonds is different from in India, because in India they'll put it with gold. In the West, they'll never put a diamond with gold. They always put it with something silver color. But it needs to show off its beauty, it needs a setting. Sometimes one sees that if there's a lady who wants to look very beautiful, she chooses the color of her sweater, of her hair thing, of her car, even just to match her hair color or something like that. Like the blonde Matajis with blonde hair, they always wear what color?
Black.
Huh?
Black.
Nowadays. What color?
White.
Black, white? And the third one is the one I'm thinking, huh?
Pink. Blonde, brown.
Red. The Western girls do that, don't they? No? No, I never noticed this. Huh?
Pinkish reddish.
They always wear reddish, pinkish. Because that brings it,
Fashions change.
But the same idea of trying to increase your beauty by putting on the right ornaments doesn't change. That's the concept we're talking about. Concept doesn't change. Just like if you have In any case, so Krishna's beauty is self-perfect. It doesn't need is bhushana bhushanangam. It doesn't need any ornament to increase its beauty. Rather than Krishna's beauty being increased when you put ornaments, the ornament's beauty is increased. Because it's self-perfect. He's not dependent on any other beauty or any other accoutrement or any other setting. He's always beautiful. Self-perfect, ever-fresh, and extremely rare. So what the gopis must have done. So there's nice explanations of these things that we won't get to, but we'll just read these two other verses. The ladies of Braja are the most fortunate of women, because with their minds fully attached to Krishna, and their throats always choked up with tears, they constantly sing about him while milking the cows, winnowing grain. We were talking about winnowing, what's it called again? Chaj?
Chaj is this colloquial, this yeah. word called soup.
Soup? I know what is soup.
No, this is another soup.
Oh, okay. Churning butter, whatever they're doing. So they see him, but they're so absorbed in him. That, because sometimes we see something, but our consciousness is not at all absorbed in it. So if we're like that, we don't get very much of a result when the object is Krishna. We see, but again, we see don't see with our eyes. We see with our consciousness. So the Braja gopis, they saw with their eyes the beauty of Krishna, but their consciousness was so absorbed in him. So they're the most fortunate because of that. Their minds were fully attached to Krishna, and their throat always choked up with tears. Whoops. Their throats were always choked up, and they were crying, and they were constantly singing about him. When were they constantly singing about him? Just when they were looking at him? No. But all the time, this is how absorbed they were. Because this is the nature of Krishna's form. If one gains attachment to him, it's all captivating. So their throat was choked up with tears. They constantly sang about him while milking the cows, while souping the grains, while churning butter, while gathering cow dung for fuel, or riding on swings, taking care of their crying babies. Whatever they were doing, their minds were somewhere else. Whatever they were doing, their minds were focused on Krishna. This is Vrindavan. They know nothing but Krishna. They were sprinkling the ground with water, cleaning their houses and so on. These are the village activities. Even today you see these going on in Vrindavan. By their exalted consciousness, they automatically acquire all desirable things. So because their consciousness is most exalted, everything that's desirable comes to them. So we have so many desires in our consciousness, in our mind, and we do sometimes unexalted things, or common things, to try to get our desires fulfilled. And we always end up not satisfied, and our desires are much greater than what we were hoping for, generally speaking. But just by focusing their consciousness on Krishna, these ladies are saying, the Braja gopis, they achieved everything. All desirable things, because what was desirable for them was Krishna, actually. So by their love for Krishna, in other words, they actually achieved the all desirable object, who is Krishna. And then the final verse in these four, this is the summit of the peak of the description, because it's gone from describing the fortune of the people of Vrindavan to the specifically the fortune of the gopis, because they were seeing him all the time, and his form was so wonderful. And then whatever they're doing, they're thinking about him. And then finally, and they get everything just by their full attachment to Krishna. And then finally, when the gopis hear Krishna playing his flute as he leaves Braja in the morning with the cows, and then returns with them, the cows, at sunset. They're hearing Krishna's flute, and Krishna's leaving in the morning, and then in the afternoon, late afternoon, Krishna's coming back. they quickly come out of their houses to see him. They must have performed many pious activities. It sounds so simple. Their eyes follow him when he goes out, and their eyes follow him when he returns. And all day long we just heard that they're thinking about him and crying and singing about him. It sounds so simple. But what's the not simple part? It's the depth of their attachment for Krishna. Because this is the highest religious principle. It's obvious that whatever the religion is, those who are attached to the object of religion, their God, the God of that religion, those who are most attached are, in every religious tradition, are considered the most advanced. So who can be more attached than the Braja Gopis? Because there is no fear, there is no desire to gain anything. Their only desire was to serve him and please him due to their natural spontaneous love for him. So when the gopis, it sounds so simple, but what's not simple is the depth of their consciousness. So therefore one can hear the Bhagavatam, these pastimes, and it sounds like a very nice, cute little story. And after we heard it once or twice, what's next? What book will we read next? But actually, it's the depth. We wish to learn how to penetrate into the depth of the consciousness of the real devotees. And what is, just get a glimpse from, even from a distance, of what is it in their consciousness that causes them to act in this way towards Krishna? What does Krishna have in his being that causes him to attract the devotees in this way, and etc. And how to develop it, and what is the goal of it. So when the gopis hear Krishna playing his flute as he leaves Braja in the morning with his cows, or returns with them at sunset, the young girls quickly come out of their houses to see him instantaneously, and nothing can stop them. Is the nature of spontaneous affection. They must have performed many, many pious activities to be able to see him as he walks on the road, coming in again, going out, his smiling face mercifully glancing upon them out of the corners of his eyes. So that was the talk of the ladies of Mathura as they saw Krishna in the wrestling arena. That's 10 verses. So it seems like we're going to discuss those verses again in the next time. We'll read the comments of Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, and Srila Prabhupada. And here Prabhupada starts his comment on it by saying, the gopis give a perfect example of how one can execute Krishna consciousness even while performing various type of material engagements. So that's how Prabhupada begins his comments. That's their example. Very, very simple. Very, very deep. Because you can't do it without attachment. Because your consciousness goes to wherever it's attached to. And then if the consciousness goes there, the body goes there later. Okay, we'll stop here. Thank you. Any questions? All right, bud. When someone's got his hand like that, it's half there already. You must have some question. Secret question. Any questions or comments? There's like a hint in this. In the middle of this action story where Kamsa is being killed, and we're in the middle of that story, there's sort of a backward glance to Vrindavan. So we don't forget in the midst of all the action of what the most wonderful thing actually is.
Seems quite amazing that there are personalities residing in Mathura who have such deep appreciation for the position of the gopis.
Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur speaks about that, and he says they are like the Dvijapatnis, because there's a difference between their consciousness and the consciousness of the gopis, actually, because they're more aware of his opulences, his aishwarya, and you actually hear it in that. But so it's interesting for us to hear about Krishna's dealings with the Braja gopis and residents of Vrindavan dealing with Krishna from the point of view of someone who's more, who has a taste for that, but also is aware of the opulences, because that's something more accessible to us. That's what I was trying to explain in the beginning, but not doing a very good job of it. It makes it easier for us to view Krishna, because if we view Krishna as dealing just with the Braja gopis and the residents of Vrindavan, because it's all Naralila, we don't see the opulence of Krishna. It can look ordinary. Okay, so he's dancing with the other people's wives in the middle of the night. I mean, is that what everyone's doing nowadays? You know. But it's the most extraordinary what's going on. Of course, that Supreme Person is expanding himself into thousands and thousands of expansions to dance with each one individually, practically speaking. Mm. But because it's Naralila, the too much opulence entering to that can harm the rasa, the nature of the relationship, the sweet flavor of Braja. Of course it can't in Braja, because nothing can upset the particular mood that the Vrindavan Vasis have. But yes, it's interesting. This was your point. It's too interesting. Okay. We shall end. So next week, Kamsa must die.
He's already dead.
Is that true? Bucky's read ahead. He read to the end of the chapter.
Dead man walking.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'll have to.
Oh, okay. That only comes of it.
Wait a minute.
But for the soul, there is neither birth nor death, having once come into being. It cannot be withered by the wind, moistened by water, etc., etc.
So the Kamsa won't die either.
Huh?
Kamsa will not die either.
But yeah, Baba, you will die, because that Kamsa won't be there anymore. The soul whose Kamsa's body will go somewhere else. But he will live forever in our memories. In that sense.
As long as we live, our memories, but the memories are so sharp. Next life, these memories will be.
How about the memories of Krishna killing Kamsa? Will they finish?
They will finish also. Our memories will finish. Next generation will have.
Next generation?
Yeah.
You mean like the children of the children of the
children? Yeah. They will have, because they will have children that are really there.
Very interesting. Okay. Hare Krishna.
So Monday, we shall try again.